Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Robert Yeager and the Tau Foundation.
So, actually, I mean, the dawn of piracy is probably just about coterminous with the dawn of moving things and people around on the ocean. Piracy's been around forever. Of course, as an American man, I'm required to think about the Roman Empire all the time. I can tell you the Roman Empire had a lot of problems with pirates. I think Julius Caesar was kidnapped by pirates at one point, briefly. So, why mention that? Well, because I think mostly our ideas of pirates, and we all think about pirates almost as often as we think about the Roman Empire, they don't come from any of those times. They come from a very specific and pretty short period of time. We're going to talk about that today and about the true nature of pirates. The things that you think are probably fanciful are often true. The things that you think are true are often fanciful. So here to put everything in the correct columns, Rebecca Simon is a pirate historian with a PhD in history from King's College London. She's the author of several books about piracy, including The Pirate's Code, Laws and Life Aboard Ship. Welcome to our conversation, Rebecca Simon.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So feel free to disagree with what I just said at the intro, but it seems as though there was this golden age of piracy. And an awful lot of our ideas, tropes, idioms, and maybe even stereotypes come out of that time.
Yeah, so the Golden Age of Piracy, that is a time period that historians generally agree upon that existed between the mid-1600s up until kind of the end of the 1720s. And this was a period where we had large organized bands of pirates who really kind of operated for themselves, especially going into the 18th century. And this is kind of the only time really in history, at least up until this point, that we see pirates who are only operating for themselves rather than working for a government or a powerful group of people. And so this is why some historians argue that these are kind of the only real quote unquote pirates. And yes, virtually every single trope, every single idea, every image we have of pirates really comes out of this time period, especially from those in the 1710s up to the 1720s, where we see the ones like Blackbeard, Anne Bonny, Mary Read, Charles Vane, et cetera, et cetera.
And there was a period of time where a lot of the people that you just named could be found in one place. There was this pirate city in the Bahamas, basically, I guess, Nassau. But say a little bit about that, about this remarkable place where they all kind of would get together.
Nassau is a really interesting location, and the Bahamas were really interesting because while, yes, they were a colony, Britain wasn't really too concerned with what was going on in the Bahamas. It wasn't really much of a producing colony. It didn't even have very many governors. And so pirates eventually gravitated towards this area because it's right in the middle of a lot of trade lanes going into the Caribbean and North America. You know, the Bahamas sits off the coast of Florida. And they all kind of settled at the major port city in the Bahamas, which was Nassau on the island of Providence. And it was kind of a lawless region just because of lack of leadership. So lots of pirates and sailors and people would come in. There were loads of taverns, lots of drinking and drunkenness, lots of prostitution. And so as a result, lots of violence and disorder. And then a former privateering captain turned pirate, Benjamin Hornigold, supposedly came in and kind of whipped the place into shape and made it much more organized. So he was referred to as the pirate king of the pirate kingdom. And Nassau then kind of became known as the place for pirates up until about 1717, when the royal governor Woodes Rogers took over and he made it his mission to basically get rid of pirates or to stop piracy. And so that's after he came in, piracy didn't end the way he hoped it would under his leadership, but he did play a role in the eventual ending of the Golden Age of Piracy.
To what degree does this kind of swarming of pirates correlate with other kinds of existing conditions? I'm thinking of the fact that you have a pretty massive expansion in maritime trade. You've got a very powerful British Navy, which means people are getting, and other navies as well, which means a lot of people are learning how to sail boats and how to be on boats. So you sort of have stuff that's ripe for the taking, and then you maybe have a group of people with some skills that would help them take it, and maybe that's compounded with the fact that the conditions on the actual British Navy ships or other nations' Navy ships are not great and are very, very hierarchical, as is the case with merchant ships. Are there sort of things like that that are coming together to produce a kind of moment?
Yeah, it's kind of a perfect storm during this golden age. So in the 1600s, what allowed piracy to flourish is that there was loads of conflict between Britain and Spain throughout the Caribbean, and particularly the ownership of Jamaica. And so when there's a lot of political contention like that, especially in an area where people are sailing and it's a large area and it's very complicated, a lot of places get neglected in terms of leadership. And there was also one of the ways Britain was really fighting against Spain was by passing the Navigation Acts, which banned all British colonies from trading with anyone outside the British Empire. And so this meant that American colonists in North America and the Caribbean suddenly couldn't trade with Spain or France or the Netherlands or Portugal. And pirates came in for this. You know, they'll rob anyone indiscriminately, and they were selling goods to colonists and governors, and some of them had support. And so it wasn't really until about 1670, when the wars between England and Spain ended with the Treaty of Madrid, that they kind of tried to start cracking down on piracy, because one of the promises was that they'd help guard Spain against British pirates. But because there had been so much contention going on, a lot of pirates did settle in Jamaica, in Port Royal, which is kind of like a little piece of land that juts out from near Kingston. And it's a tiny little fishing village. But that kind of became like a big center for piracy because of it was a port city and of also its proximity. But in the 1690s, 1692, there was an earthquake that destroyed a lot of Port Royal. Pirates scattered. And then another war broke out a few years later, 1701, the War of Spanish Succession, which required tons of skilled sailors. So pirates received a pardon. They were forgiven for their crimes if they decided to join Britain as privateers, basically mercenaries to attack enemy ships on water. And then when the war ended in 1713, these privateers were out of work and they made loads of good money. They were able to keep 80% of the loot that they stole. And so a lot of these veterans decided to turn to piracy and keep doing what they were doing. And these veterans are the really infamous pirates we know of: Benjamin Hornigold, Edward Teach, known as Blackbeard, Charles Vane, Henry Jennings, Jack Rackham. They are all veterans of this massive war. And so they were able to, so they all kind of knew each other or knew of each other. And they were able to kind of create lots of organized bands of growing piracy.
And let's talk also a little bit about that organization. And let's maybe play off the title of the book of yours that I mentioned. I don't think that Pirates of the Caribbean movies are a great source of historical data, but they do talk about pirate codes. Let's play A1, Mr. Reyes.
What? Parley. I invoke the right of parley. According to the code of the brethren set down by the pirates Morgan and Bartholomew, you have to take me to your captain.
I know the code.
If an adversary demands parley, you can do them no harm until the parley is complete.
Blazes with the code.
She wants to be taken to the captain.
And she'll go without a fuss. We must honor the code.
All right. As I said, maybe not perfectly historically accurate, but the notion of a code is very much there. And these codes, multi-article codes, were pretty elaborate, right?
They were. And what's so funny is that the clip you just showed is actually kind of how I started the introduction of the book, The Pirate's Code. Mm-hmm. And there was a code, and it was known as the Pirate Articles. And what they were was that they were basically a series of rules and regulations on the pirate ship. And they were very organized. There were things like about the equal distribution of goods and money from what they stole, depending on your rank, and about how, if they were going to be, how punishments would be dealt out. They had to be done unanimously. Being paid, compensated for injuries such as losing a limb or a finger or an eye, you'd get compensated certain amounts of money for it. anything from like keeping, you know, making sure to keep your weapons clean, not firing anything below deck because it can cause a fire. You know, some pirates banned activities like drinking and gambling because they thought it would make pirates really unruly. Some of them banned women on ships because they didn't want to cause complications. And so we do know of at least 4 pirate articles. And the most detailed one comes from the pirate Edward Lowe. And that's because his code was actually published in newspapers in colonial America after his death. And so these articles did exist. Pirates supposedly had to swear on these articles. If they captured someone and made them a hostage and forced them into piracy, they would force the person to swear on the articles. And so basically all pirates had to follow this. In terms of parlay, like what they were talking about with Pirates of the Caribbean, that was invented for the movie. Parlay was a thing, but it was really more of a naval agreement. And that came about much later than in the movie, but it makes for a good plot point to get her onto the ship. So they're correct about there being a code, but they're not correct about parlay.
So, I mean, the other part of this, I mean, there's so much that in preparing for the show came as something of a surprise to me. And you watch comedy shows like Our Flag Means Death, and you think that they're making up all kinds of stuff that actually turns out to be kind of true. But one of the things about this was these crews could be rather diverse in the way that they are constituted. Can you say a little bit about who might be on a pirate ship?
Yeah, of course. And that is something I actually really appreciate about the Pirates of the Caribbean films and the show Our Flag Means Death and the show Black Sails, is that they really do show extremely diverse crews of pirates. The average pirate ship could be about 50% British, white British. But the other 50% were, you had Africans and you would have, French people, you would have Germans, Irish, Scots, you would have sometimes indigenous people, although that was pretty rare. Sometimes even people from East Asia. But yeah, overall, you have a very diverse ship. And that's because they needed a crew and they're sailing all over. It's good to have different languages, that could be spoken on the ship. There is kind of this idea that pirates are like these perfect, almost utopias for all marginalized folk. That's not really true, but it was a place where maybe you couldn't get work elsewhere, such as maybe because you're an enslaved person or a former enslaved person or maybe a religious minority. It could be a place for you to work.
Right. They're not having DEI workshops or anything like that, but it kind of works out that way. And one of the things they don't need a DEI workshop for is age discrimination, because as I understand it, pirates had rather short careers that were often brought very short in a violent manner.
That's true. Yeah. When someone became a pirate, their average lifespan usually is about 2 years as a pirate on average. I actually did once, it was for research for this book, because I wanted to make sure, I went and found like a list of pirates and their years as pirates, a really long list, and averaged out how long they were pirates, and it averaged out to like 2.1 years. So it's about 2 years. And this is because they're going to either die in battle, they're going to get captured, or they're probably going to, or they'll get sick, injured and or sick. And in fact, actually, usually it's injury and illness was like kind of the number one cause of death on ships for everybody, and pirates included, because of unsanitary conditions. So it's a hard life. And that's one of the reasons why you have these pirate articles, is because in order for pirates to really survive, they have to be really organized and they have to be in full agreement and know what the rules are and maintain a lot of discipline. So in some ways, pirate ships weren't chaotic. They were extremely disciplined.
Maybe the last question before we break here, and we both kind of alluded to it, I think, but why become a pirate? I mean, it seems as though why become a pirate includes the fact that this is a time of very stratified and hierarchical societies in the the so-called legit world. And there was, in fact, maybe a little bit more opportunity to change one's station in life by becoming a pirate. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that could happen for some people. There were many reasons why someone became a pirate. It could be that, maybe they were veterans of something like the War of Spanish Succession and worked as privateers and decided to kind of, go pirating for themselves once their contract ran out. There were people who willfully joined a pirate ship because, you know, poor working conditions on merchant ships or naval ships. Pirate ships, you actually could generally be a bit healthier because when pirates plundered a ship, they would keep 50%, like 50% of what they would steal was meant to replenish their supplies and for repairs. So they had more access to fresh food than, say, other sailors would. So some better conditions. There were some people who had no choice. It was either because they were forced into piracy, usually as hostages, or because they couldn't get work elsewhere. And so, yeah. And there were a lot of people, you know, if pirates were lucky and they stole enough loot, you know, they could do one or two pirate voyages and then retire pretty nicely.
Yeah. Well, we know that from heist movies, that last big haul, the last heist you're going to do, that's the one that always gets you.
All right.
We're talking to Rebecca Simon right now, the author of several books about piracy, including The Pirate's Code, Laws and Life Aboard Ship. We'll be back in just a second.
My name is Captain Kidd, and God's laws I did forbid, and most wickedly I did as I sailed. My father taught me well to shun the gates of hell, but against him I rebelled as I sailed. He shoved the Bible in my hand, but I left it in the sand, and I pulled away from...
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygenating it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the Go team, we'll actually take that technology to another hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to Hartford for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
At last I've reached my peak. Peter killed, and all the boys about to walk the plank. Ha 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 ha! I'm the greatest villain of all time. Who is Bluebeard?
No one!
Who is Nero?
No one!
Who is Jack the Ripper?
Nobody!
Ha 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 ha! Who's the swiniest swine in the world?
Captain Hook! Captain Hook!
Who's the dirtiest dog in this wonderful world?
Captain Hook! Captain Hook!
Captain of villainy!
Oh, I love Cyril Richard so much. All right, so we're back. We're talking about real pirates with Rebecca Simon, a pirate historian with a PhD in history from King's College London, the author of several books about piracy, including The Pirate's Code, Laws and Life Aboard Ship. So, Rebecca, you know, I mean, obviously, Peter Pan is but one of many, many iterations. We could be here all day. We already referred to some of them in the first segment. Doing a little bit of reading for this show, I got the sense that pirates is kind of a source of, I don't know, inspiration and thrills and stuff like that, like in pamphlets and maybe even little stage dramatizations. I mean, it might even go back as far as the golden age of piracy, right? There was sort of a sense that pirates were colorful and entertaining even back then, or do I have this wrong?
No, there was a bit of like almost a morbid fascination for pirates. It's interesting because in London in particular, there was a real morbid fascination. Colonial America, it was a little different because they were the ones who were facing the pirate problem head on. And so much of their economy was maritime based. So it was a bit of a different view in North America. But there was a romanticism because of kind of what we said before about how some pirates were able to you know, make a good living. And generally, there wasn't much of a social ladder. If you're born poor, you're going to stay poor. Your children will be poor, your grandchildren, et cetera, et cetera. But pirates could start out really poor, and then they could become quite wealthy, depending on how well they do. And that's really fascinating. And there's also kind of this idea, you know, these people aren't working for anybody except for themselves. They're traveling to all these exotic locations that people only hear about. And so when people are reading about pirates in pamphlets and newspapers, they sell very quickly. Pirates were executed publicly and hundreds, if not thousands, of people would attend these executions. And if there were pirate trials, they were published verbatim, and they would always sell out really quickly. So they were a good moneymaker. And so as a result, we do start to get like a lot of interest in piracy. And then in 1724, Captain Charles Johnson publishes the book, A General History of the Pirates, which is a huge tome. It was published in two volumes of biographies of pirates, many of which were heavily exaggerated and fictionalized, some fictionalized entirely, such as Anne Bonny and Mary Read. And this became a huge hit. And to this day, it's still in print. It's never gone out of print. I was finding advertisements for it, going up into the 1750s. So it was a huge bestseller. And this is the book that inspired Robert Louis Stevenson, 150 years later, when he wrote the novel Treasure Island. And it's Treasure Island where we get virtually every single idea of what we think is true about pirates.
Right. This is where we start getting eye patches and peg legs and parrots on shoulders and things like that.
Yep, exactly.
So let's wreck a couple of those. One we can wreck is, I think you already heard Cyril Richard mention it, walking the plank. That's kind of not really a thing.
No, that was not a standard punishment. Standard punishments would be whippings or marooning at the very worst. Sometimes keel hauling, which is where you're tied to a rope, thrown overboard, and you kind of get dragged underneath the ship and barnacles cut you up, or you'll drown or you'll die of injury. That was very rare, but it happened just enough to know that it was true. Walking the plank, though, was not a thing. That was kind of an invention in pop culture later. Maybe it was sort of kind of a play on the idea of keel hauling, but really, if people were going to get punished, for the most part, it was whipping and imprisonment or marooning.
Okay, let's wreck one other thing, buried treasure.
Oh, yeah, that's my favorite thing to wreck. There is no buried treasure. I've had some people tell me, oh, Captain Kidd, he buried treasure. No, he did not. In 1701, he was a pirate who operated in the Indian Ocean, and he was arrested, and he tried to see if he could get out of it by claiming he had buried all the goods that he stole, but nothing was ever found, and he actually unloaded everything he stole in the Caribbean, sold it to like the governor of the Bahamas, basically. And so he didn't have anything, but this is where all the rumors started. And so, a lot of people say that, there's buried treasure. This pirate buried his treasure, or they were capturing treasure, or, the Spanish treasure fleet. Like, and I'm like, okay, none of that is buried treasure. Those are shipwrecks where stuff would wash up onto the ocean. But also what we have to understand is that even in documents, if we see the word treasure, in the 17th and 18th century, treasure just meant valuable. So that could mean anything, not gold or jewels for the most part. It would be things like textiles, wine, other rum, sugar, anything that could be spices, anything that could be sold for a pretty hefty profit. So, and plus also pirates, they would steal their goods, go on land, sell them, spend their money, run out of money, go back to pirating. There was no reason for a pirate ever to offload and bury anything. They'd have no time, and they'd never get back to it.
They were kind of living paycheck to paycheck, basically.
Exactly.
So we would be remiss if we did not talk a little bit about some of the women who are pirates, and notably Mary Read and Anne Bonny. You've written an entire book about this. First of all, we'll talk a little bit about Anne Bonny, probably the more famous of the two. I don't know whether that's right or not. That's sort of the name that I knew. So we have a feisty Irish woman, as I understand it. Is there any other kind? And tell us a little bit more about her.
So Anne Bonny is more famous, and that's because we have more historical documentation about her. And so she was Irish, and her family, they moved to the American colonies and to the Carolinas when she was a young girl. And so she marries a sailor named James Bonny and kind of runs away with him. And then they're married for several years. We don't really know what they were doing while she was sailing with him. But we do know that by the time they land in Nassau, their marriage has basically fallen apart. They split, and Anne Bonny is known to frequent taverns. She falls in love with a pirate named Jack Rackham, and they want to marry. So Jack Rackham offers to purchase her from James Bonny. This wasn't a very unusual practice. There was a huge disparity between men and women in the Caribbean, so wife selling wasn't very uncommon. But the governor, Woods Rogers, had outlawed wife selling, and so he threatened to have Anne Bonny beaten if she was sold, because it would be her fault, obviously. I'm being facetious. Mm-hmm. And so Jack Rackham actually ends, they actually end up running away together secretly. Jack Rackham steals a ship, he's got his crew, and then they go and sail off. And this is in August of 1720. And somehow another female pirate winds up on board named Mary Read. And now we don't know anything about where Mary Read comes from. There is no certain documentation of her before this. There are only two sources I found that could possibly be her. One is that there was a petition in about 1706 around there of a whole of 42 wives in Jamaica whose husbands were captured and imprisoned for piracy. And they wrote a letter to Queen Anne begging for them to all be pardoned. And one of the signatures is Mary Read. So it's possible she may have already been in the Caribbean. She may have had exposure to piracy, but we're not sure. There's another document of a woman who had two children and her husband had been a pirate and he had been killed. And she's writing to the pirate captain saying, you know, please send us his share or else we will be destitute. And one of the names she mentions is a daughter named Mary. Her husband was John Read. So that is another possibility, but we don't know. But we do know that the rumor is that Mary Read had disguised herself as a man. Mm-hmm. This comes from A General History of the Pirates, but that's fiction. Woods Rogers issued a warrant for their arrest and specifically mentioned Anne Bonny and the female pirate Mary Read. So it was known that she was a woman.
Yeah, that idea that both of them at times pretended to be a man seems to be around and seems not to be true.
Yeah, it comes from A General History of the Pirates. There are hostages at their trial. The hostages who survived their attacks all said the same thing. They said that Anne Bonny and Mary Read wore men's clothing during battle, but once battle was over, they wore women's clothing. So they were only wearing men's clothing just for practical purposes. There is kind of this rumor that, you know, maybe they were cross-dressing, maybe transgender, or maybe the two of them were actually in love and had a romantic relationship. There's no evidence of any of that. They only wore men's clothing just for fighting. Both of them were married to, you know, Anne Bonny is married to James Rackham or Jack Rackham. Mary Read marries another sailor on the ship. They're both pregnant at their trial. So, you know, but a lot of that romanticism comes from A General History of the Pirates. And the whole idea that the two of them may have had a relationship is actually kind of a 20th century concept.
Okay. Clearly, all the things that I like about this story are going to be the fault of Charles Johnson, but that's fine. So one of the things that I liked was this idea that on one occasion, Mary Read had a lover or boyfriend or perhaps husband or something who was about to be challenged to a duel by some other person. And she just dueled with the guy and killed the guy so her boyfriend wouldn't have to bother with it. I'm assuming that's the same kind of embellishment you've been talking about.
It is, yeah. So it makes for a really great story, and it's in A General History of the Pirates. But there's been no actual evidence of that. That was never stated in any of the trials. No eyewitnesses ever mentioned it. So it's very unlikely. Jack Rackham, you know, they only sailed for 2 months as pirates, and they were mostly just kind of hanging around the coast, going after fishing ships or fishing boats and small merchant ships. There wasn't really a case of any of them actually like stopping on an island somewhere for a duel to take place.
All right, let's look at another embellishment. This is a real embellishment, but it's about two actual historical figures here. This we've already mentioned, the show Our Flag Means Death. You're going to hear Steve Bonnet and Edward Teach, a.k.a. Blackbeard, have a little chat on Our Flag Means Death. This is B2, Mr. Ray.
I don't know if I want to go back to the old days. Just drinking all day and biting the heads off turtles or making some poor bloke eat his own toes as a laugh.
Yuck. Where's the laugh there?
I suppose what I'm saying is I right now I just want to do what makes Ed happy.
And what makes Ed happy?
These past few weeks have been most fun I've had in ages, years, maybe ever. So I reckon what makes Ed happy is you.
We're gonna wreck that, but It's charming and it's funny, but it's almost certainly not true, right?
Oh, our flag means death is 99% is 99% fiction. The only thing it gets right, these are the only things the show gets right, is that Steve Bonnet was a wealthy plantation owner in Barbados who just decided one day he wanted to be a pirate, bought a ship, hired a crew, and actually paid them a salary, which was very unusual, and that he was educated and he dressed very nicely and that he would end up sailing with Blackbeard. That is it. He and Blackbeard never had a romantic relationship. In fact, Blackbeard did not like Steve Bonnet. He felt that Steve Bonnet was really incompetent as a sailor, and he only really paired up with him because Steve Bonnet had a good sized ship and he had a lot of money. But he was so incompetent that, you know, at the end of the show, spoilers, at the end of the show, you know, Steve Bonnet abandons Blackbeard and it's heartbreaking, blah, blah, blah. In reality, Blackbeard abandoned Steve Bonnet and turned him and his crew over to the authorities. And so Blackbeard could take a pardon and like live peacefully for a while. So that is completely flipped in the show. Again, like I said, they had no real friendship. They didn't even sail on the same ship. And most of Rackham's crew preferred to sail with Blackbeard. So, you know, none of that relationship is real. And then also kind of, you know, it's funny for Blackbeard to kind of flippantly say in the show, like, you know, I miss like, you know, eating turtles and forcing people to eat their own toes and blah, blah, blah. Blackbeard actually, even though he was very theatrical and, you know, he put like fuses in his beard so that way it looked like so there was smoke coming off of him as they were boarding ships, but he actually wasn't violent. He actually never killed a single person until his very final battle, and he would order his crew to not kill people. He just went on intimidation, and he wanted to get in and out as fast as possible. So a lot of people will, like, I know so many people love Our Flags Means Death. I know it's become a very beloved show. I know some people get irritated at me when I point this out because they're saying the show isn't meant to be historically accurate, and I'm kind of like, but these are two historical figures and they've completely upended their history and now it's what people believe. And I'm like, they could have just made some fictional pirates. But anyways, well, that's me ripping it apart.
two real quick things. This is another thing that you can you don't even need to rip it apart because I kind of already knew this one wasn't true. But our friend Charles Johnson said that Steve Bonnet was driven to piracy by his wife's nagging and, quote, discomforts he found in married state, which sounds exactly like something that would maybe come out of Our Flag Means Death, but doesn't feel particularly true. But the idea of kind of a bookish pirate is, I think, kind of real in the case of Bonnet, or as far as anybody knows anyway. And it doesn't seem to be that unique. I wound up reading about a guy named William Dampier who wrote Observations of the Natural World while his shipmates pillaged and plundered and raided. I mean, he was recording publishable work almost as a naturalist. So I guess not all of these pirates were woefully undereducated.
No, not at all. And Steve Bonnet, a detail that the show got correct. I mean, my favorite episode of the whole series is the pilot episode, because that's where they get 90% of it is factual. And I was really impressed. But then after that, not so much. But Steve Bonnet was highly educated and he did bring his library with him on ship. Pirate captains were almost always literate and they were almost always educated, because that's generally how it was. A pirate captain was going to be the one who was the most savvy in terms of navigation and, you know, tactics and that sort of thing. They would be very experienced and they would have to be literate. They have to read logs. They would have to write letters. They would have to record goods, everything like that. So Blackbeard, for instance, you know, he grew up middle class in a merchant community. He was educated. Benjamin Hornigold was educated. Jack Rackham was very educated. You know, Charles Vane, they were all very educated people. And we actually find, a copy of the Voyage of the South Seas was actually discovered, excavated off of Blackbeard's ship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, where they've been doing a really big excavation project for the past 20 years off the coast of North Carolina. They found some remnants of pages from that book. So it shows that not only were they literate, were many pirates literate, but that, you know, they enjoyed these stories too. Now, the pirates who had more menial jobs, you know, they most likely probably were not literate, because there were many sailors who were not literate and they were the ones who had the more menial jobs, such as doing like repairs, cleaning, maybe cooking, stuff where they didn't need to know how to read and write. But it's kind of a mixed bag, but a lot more pirates were literate than we think.
All right. We're talking to Rebecca Simon. We have time for a short final segment. Let's grab a quick break and we'll come back and we'll do that.
Bold and Bonnie went to sea. Yo, ho, ho, and a bottle of rum. Aboard the good ship Modesty. Billy Bones, the old man gun. Swell of the waves and the call of the salty sea. And seven scurvy rats with company.
All episodes of The Colin McEnroe Show are available 24/7 on any podcast app. If there's a place for reviews and ratings, give us lots of stars and be sure to mention the high thread count in our sheets and pillowcases, as well as the complimentary breakfast buffet. Have a question or comment? Email us at colinshow@ctpublic.org. Now, back to the show.
The technical producer of today's show, making a guest appearance, a pirate from the high seas himself, Mr. Dylan Reyes. This episode was actually produced by McCusker, a.k.a. Carolyn McCusker. And we are going to conclude with a little bit more talk with Rebecca Simon, pirate historian with Ph.D. in history from King's College London, the author of several books about piracy, including The Pirate's Code, Laws and Life Aboard Ship. So, Rebecca, this sounds fanciful. Like, as I said at the beginning of the show, things that sound fanciful turn out to be true. Things that sound true turn out to be fanciful. But one of the true things seems to be some kind of spirit of, at least in some instances, egalitarianism. We've alluded to this already, that there were effectively constitutions and codes governing groups of pirates. But this was something that was surprisingly prevalent. Say more about it.
Yeah. So what's really fascinating about pirate ships is that there had to be unanimous agreements about punishments, and a captain could get voted out if the pirates felt that he wasn't doing a good job. So a reason why a captain might get voted out might be because, you know, they aren't capturing many prizes or ships, or they feel that the captain maybe is playing it a little too safe, or in some rare cases, they discover the captain is hoarding some of the extra goods for himself, and that's a huge offense. And so these would be reasons why the pirates on the ship would vote him out and elect in a new captain. And also, on pirate ships, if there was going to be a punishment, there was literally kind of almost a council of all the pirates, and they would all have to unanimously agree on what they felt the fair punishment was. And this is very unusual because this sort of practice did not exist on merchant ships or naval ships. Captains did not get voted out. Punishments were doled out without permission or without any sort of authorization from any general member of the crew. So this is very different on pirate ships. And part of the reason is because you had to keep morale up and you had to make it like pretty much an equal society in order to keep people happy and working together well. So it was all, and this is one of the key things to a pirate survival, was a really well-functioning ship with good camaraderie. And so in a way, pirate ships, you know, they had almost like a bit of an egalitarianism among the ship or on the ship more than other maritime businesses did.
I mean, this, once again, it almost gets into our flag means death territory in the case of, for example, Captain Bartholomew Sharp, whose crew said it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. What are you going to do about it? Tell us that story.
So there was supposedly Captain Bartholomew Sharp. The crew was upset with him. I think this is when they were in the South Seas. I forget. But they were quite upset with him not getting enough prizes, or they didn't think he was doing a good job as a captain. And so one of the things Bartholomew Sharp decided to do was to have them all celebrate Christmas. They docked on an island and they hunted for boar and they drank and they ate fresh meat and they found tropical fruits and they ate all those and they celebrated for several days. And this was to help kind of rebuild the crew's morale. And it worked. It worked for a little while, but then after a time, you know, once again, Bartholomew Sharp started to run into a lot of mutterings from people on the ship.
It seems as though, yeah, so it didn't entirely work out for him. He got neat anyway, but I guess that's not the right way to use that verb, but you know what I mean. So, yeah, it seems as though that also seeped into the popular imagination. And there were things that are probably legends, as I was reading for the show, I read about a place called Libertatia or Libertatia, an integrated, harmonious, multiracial, and anti-imperialist society. I think it was on an island north of Madagascar. And there was this, even this idea that they would prey upon slave ships and liberate people who were being transported in the transatlantic slave trade. That's all not true, but probably anyway, it's probably legend, right? But there is this idea that this code of honor and this sense of egalitarianism might be one that the pirates even sort of transferred outside their ship, maybe even to cruel merchant sea captains or something. Say a little bit more about how that spirit showed up.
So, yeah, you're right in that Libertalia was, it's pretty much fiction. It's kind of fantasy. And it's sort of born out of this idea that, you know, a pirate ship was a place where marginalized folk could actually work, unlike other ships, other merchant ships. We like to think that pirates were sort of these liberators and really progressive people, especially in terms of enslaved people. But this wasn't really as true as we think. There were cases where when pirates robbed a ship, if there was an enslaved person or two on the ship, pirates included them into their cargo because they were seen as cargo. Pirates would not generally go after slave ships until after the slave ships had been unloaded. And this is because slave ships are some of the most powerful ships in the world at the time. And so the major slave ships like the Widow that Samuel Bellamy managed to capture, which was the largest and fastest slave ship in the world at the time, he didn't capture it until after they had already offloaded all the enslaved people. And it was the same thing when Blackbeard captured La Concorde and renamed it the Queen Anne's Revenge. You know, he waited till after the enslaved people. In fact, what's interesting is that Blackbeard actually did rob a slave ship and brought in like 160 enslaved people onto a ship and incorporated them into his crew. But then later when they docked, he actually ended up selling them. So pirates weren't exactly these liberators that we really think that we think of all the time.
All right. Well, I think we're out of time here, but this has really been fascinating stuff. Rebecca Simon, you seem to know everything about pirates. pirate historian with a PhD in history from King's College London, the author of several books about piracy, including The Pirate's Code, Laws and Life Aboard Ship. Thanks so much for joining us today. And thanks to you, to the rest of you, for joining us as well. I think you are going to be asked now to support this show through your pledges. So please do that so we don't have to become pirates and just take it from you.
Yes, I am a pirate, 200 years too late. The cannons don't thunder, there's nothing to plunder. I'm an overboard victim of fate, arriving too late.